Thanks, David. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Great to hear Bob Surratt on the WGN dial. Awesome to see him as well. I remember going to Columbia College and having the opportunity to meet Bob as he spoke to our class. So always great to have worked with him before and get a chance to work with him again. See Bob Surratt here on 720 WGN. That was great. All right, it is Extension 720 tonight, and we're on with you until 10 o'clock. I am Justin Kaufman, 312-981-7200. We got a special program tonight. We're going to get right into it. As we talk about Chicago violence, when we talk about Chicago violence, we always seem to talk about a couple of pockets on the south and west sides, neighborhoods like Englewood, Austin, or back of the yards. The chaos is far away, so you don't have to think about it. And the story of the people who live there are actually told through the 10 o'clock news.
Shot and killed while doing nothing more than driving down Ashland in the back of the yards neighborhood.
A frightening crime. A teenage girl was brutally gunned down in the back of the yards neighborhood.
Those individuals killed a passenger and wounded a driver in the back of the yards neighborhood.
Home on Chicago's south side is shot up with an assault weapon in broad daylight, terrifying one family and a neighborhood.
This all happened yesterday afternoon in the 4300 block of South Marshfield in the city's back of the yards neighborhood.
Tonight, we take one of those neighborhoods and let them tell their own story. Back of the yards, you just heard it in all those newscasts. It's located right in the heart of the south side of Chicago, 51st and Racine, all the surrounding area. And some of the blocks in that surrounding area are most dangerous in the city. Tonight, we hear from some of the people and the Chicago organizations trying to make a difference. And for many who are going to hear tonight, it's just about trying to survive. This summer, Pete and I, along with longtime Chicago TV and radio analyst Marge Halperin, spent a couple of days in back of the yards talking to formerly incarcerated men, young mothers, teenagers, and those who are trying to provide precious support and resources to the community. Marge is my co-host tonight as we take on this subject for the entirety of Extension 720. Marge, great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. I'm really happy to be able to help tell these stories.
So what drew you? Because you pitched this idea, and we want to put this show together. What was it about this story that drew your attention?
Well, as you said, I've done radio, TV for a long time in this town. I've always been a community-based reporter, and what happens in communities is always of a deep interest to me. Lately, I've also been a community activist. I'm on the board of Indivisible Chicago, which is a progressive alliance that fights for progressive values, among them an end to gun violence and increased gun reforms, sensible gun control, whatever words you want to put on it. We need to get guns off the street. And that introduced me to one of our guests today with the Illinois Coalition Against Handgun Violence, and you'll meet Sarah in a second.
Yeah.
And she took me to a lot of meetings in a lot of neighborhoods. And in the back of the yards, I learned about the programs that were coming out of the community. Now, when I was a reporter for other radio stations that maybe we don't mention on this station, but several others, in the 80s, 90s, there were a lot of community organizations that were based downtown. They were based maybe on the north side, and I'll just be blunt because tonight's a night for blunt talking. A lot of well-meaning white folks who went into communities, organized people of color, brought busloads of seniors to people's gas to complain about high rates and to ask for relief and to come to City Hall. And we'd cover these groups. They'd come on a bus. They'd go back home. Their organizers would go back home as well. But what's happened in the last 10 years or so is that organizations have developed from within the community, where they're grounded in the community. It's, you know, of, by, and for the people. So it's closer connections, more direct impact, people who have lived the experience in the neighborhood, who know how to help their neighbors get through the experiences and find a better path. And those are the programs that will be represented tonight.
Well, tonight we have a panel of guests in studio to talk about gun violence in Chicago, what we need to know about this epidemic, and what they're doing in their work. Father David Kelly is the executive director of the Precious Blood Ministries of Reconciliation, which has set up shop in an old elementary school right there at 51st and Troop. Sam Castro is the director of programs with the Institute of Nonviolence for Nonviolence in Chicago. And Sarah Kanishkik, I came as close as I possibly could there. Kanishka, I'll get it by the end of the program, is an organizer for the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence. And we welcome you to the panel, but also we welcome your text and your calls tonight, 312-981-7200. Before we get to the panel and we start talking this out, let's start tonight with some of the young men, and I should say the young boys, that we met who live in the area and frequent Precious Blood and the Institute for Nonviolence Chicago. We heard from, they're going to hear from Anthony here, Joshua, Rondell, Savion, and Tamarion, all between 15 and 17 years old. Let's hear a little bit of their stories.
somebody dies every day in Chicago. So one of these days, maybe it could be us. So we tend not to stay in the neighborhood.
You can't be in the same spot. You just got to keep moving around. Be in the same spot. It ain't right.
You could talk to the wrong person. It could start a problem. Or that person could be willing to set you up and put you in risk.
My mom, she said she don't need to game in and stuff. Like, she believe I'd be going down that, like, road. But I don't, like, to me, game bang is stupid.
I live on the 56th side of Garfield, but I hang around, like, across, like, towards 54th. And they into it. They not supposed to be with each other. But I walk through that every day. I'm just...
You feel safe doing that? You feel safe, like, walking back and forth?
Yeah. Because I ain't doing nothing. I don't game bang. Everybody know I don't game bang. Everybody just know I just hang over there with the kids.
I'm not a follower. I choose to lead by definition, because if I choose to join the gang life, I won't have anything better going for myself.
We can't do nothing, even if you don't gang bang. It's like if...
Association by affiliation. So it's you are who you're with. Like, you are where your neighborhood's from, right, or who's in your neighborhood. So that's...
Asking questions or nothing like that. You feel me? They seen you before, then... Just better hope they don't got a gun or anything like that, because you might die.
Some boys from the Back of the Yards neighborhood: Anthony Rojas, Joshua Vasquez, Rondell Coleman, Savion Hill, and Tamarion John, all between 15 and 17 years old. Tonight, we talk about their stories, and we hear from them and others as we investigate and explore violence in Back of the Yards. Our panel is standing by. We'll take our first break here. We'll come back, and we'll start the conversation here on Extension 720. Stay with us. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin, my co-host today, Marge Halperin, who is here. We're talking a little bit, or I wouldn't say a little bit, I'd say the whole program, about Chicago violence. And we have a panel that's here, and we're going to hear from people who live and have experienced violence, and also are part of the Back of the Yards community, as we were down there this summer talking to a lot of different people putting together this program. Father David Kelly is the executive director of the Precious Blood Ministries of Reconciliation, which is right there at 51st and Troop. Father Kelly, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Sam Castro, the director of programs with the Institute for Nonviolence Chicago. Sam, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Sarah Konishnik is the organizer for the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence. Sarah, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So you heard a little bit of the kids and their stories as we just kind of montaged that together right before the break. None of that has to surprise you as you hear some really adult themes coming out of how they feel about being a teenager, how they feel about being a kid in Back of the Yards. Father Kelly, let me start with you. You know, with the work that you're doing and the kids coming in there, it can't be a shock to hear those stories.
No, we hear them a lot, and they're mixture of stories. Some of them, they love the Back of the Yards, they want to be there, they want to return after they become successful, whatever successful means. And then others will say, and maybe the same kid on a different day will say, I want to leave, I just got to get out of here, I want to be someplace else. So it's those kind of mixtures that happen with I think is what we find in the young people a lot of times anyhow.
Sam, same thing from you, from the Institute, that you hear those stories, and we're going to talk about your personal story growing up, but just when you hear those stories, what comes to mind?
Just like Father Kelly was saying, on any given day, they got high hopes and expectations, and maybe the following day is like, it's over with for me, like, life is no good, I don't have no place to go. And unfortunately, because of the bad decisions they make, so we never know how or what they're going through till we see them the next day, unless we get a phone call from them.
Sarah, you know, I asked the same question for you. And your perch over at the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence, you know, obviously gun violence is becoming, if not the number one priority in the city of Chicago. When you hear those kind of stories and you know what's happening in some of these neighborhoods, what's your response to it?
My reaction is that I wish people outside of these communities where this type of everyday gun violence is happening to everyone throughout the day. My response is, I wish people from communities like mine, I live in a fully served community, could really understand what people who live in these communities and the people like the people on this panel who are working hard to reduce these levels of violence. I would like people outside of those communities to understand the incredible stories and what it's really like to go through the day not really knowing if you're going to make it to bedtime, right? That's what I'm interested in.
When I listen to the struggles that we've talked to more than a dozen people, just the understanding that, as someone I think is going to say later in the show, you never know when the bullet's going to have your name on it. And I think about the work you do, Sarah, with the coalition to try to get guns off the street. I see what a disconnect there is between the political debate that goes on about guns, no guns, NRA, who's got the power, and then every day people are being shot in the street, not just in back of the yards, in many neighborhoods in our city and in other cities around the country. How do you balance what you know about the community and then you've got the other foot in this political world?
What I try to do is explain to people that we don't have five or six different types of gun violence problems. We have one gun violence problem. It is too easy for people who should not have a gun to get one. And the solutions that will help reduce gun violence in communities like Back of the Yards will also make children in communities like mine, which is a fairly affluent suburb, it will make them safer in their schools. So I spend a lot of time trying to help people understand that we're all, it's all one problem, and we all have to work together to resolve it.
Father Kelly, I want to bring you in and talk a little bit about Precious Blood Ministries. And because for both of you, for you and Sam, these interviews happen with kids who are participating in your programs. Right. They're not necessarily after school. They're now they are, but they were in the summer. They were summer camps or they were hanging around. Talk about what you're trying to do with the kids in Back of the Yards.
So first of all, Precious Blood is a community-based organization. So we're in the community because we want to be in deep relationship with the young people and the families in that community. So we don't drive in at a certain time and drive home at another time. We live in that community. Most of the staff are from that community. So when young people come in, they're met with familiar faces, who they might see in the park, who they might see at the local restaurant or wherever they might see them. So it's really this kind of a family kind of a thing that we're trying to promote, where people come in not for a particular purpose, like you have to have a reason to be there or an appointment to be there. Kids come in, they like all kids, they're hungry, and they go to the refrigerator and get something to eat. And in those moments, those just normal moments, we'll pull them aside or we'll find a corner and we'll say, hey, what's going on, how you doing, what, you know, and talk to them about that day. We'll get on them for not going to school if they didn't go to school, and we'll do a host of different kinds of things like that just to build relationships. So Precious Blood is all about relationships, because unless you have that deep relationship with someone, you're really not going to be able to provide them the resources that they need. Because you might presume you know, but unless you listen, unless they inform you, then that's how we respond to with our program or anything else that we're doing.
Sam, same thing, right? Relationships have to play a huge role in what you're doing with kids at the Institute.
So based upon the relationships in the community, so many of them have never been out of so many square mile radius. So one of the events that we did with this a small group of them, we took them a few hours away to a campground where they rode ponies, jumped in a lake, a pond. We had another situation where we took 20 of them to Six Flags Great America. So unfortunately for some of these young boys, they've never been nowhere. So for them to go there and think like, wow, I can do this and I'm here, the sad part is when they go back home, it's like they don't know, like, am I the next one?
You know, and you see this a lot in some of the tape that we're going to present, that it's not black and white. It's not an easy scenario. You're going to have some kids, as you just said, who are going to love this. They're going to go home and they may get into trouble. They may be not necessarily innocent victims caught in the crossfire. For you, Father Kelly, to recognize the intricacies and the gray area when you're trying to help a kid and save a kid, what do you have to do that? What do you have to do to get the kid to buy in?
Well, we're kind of lucky because young people want to be there. So people like Sam and some of the Sam's team, the Institute for Nonviolence, the outreach workers, they're out there. They're engaging these young people after school, maybe even before school. Some of our case managers and our program people are from the community. So it's kind of like going to be with your bigger brother or something like that. So kids want to be there. The key is to really help them to believe that they have a future and they deserve a future. And to help them to say, you know what, I'm not going to do this because I want to be, you know, this kind of a person. And that's where our staff, ourselves, we really try to walk with them and encourage them and kind of support them when they're feeling down, when they feel like, forget it, F it, mm-hmm. I'm not going to do anything. Mm-hmm. And to say, no, there is a future, and to kind of be with them. So it's really, I know I'm going to say this a lot during this segment, but it's about relationships and letting them know that you care. Because you can't see me, but I'm an old white guy. And so as an old white guy, I'll never know what it's like to grow up in the back of the arts community. I'll never know what it's like to grow up a black or brown young person. But what I can communicate to them is that I have their best interests at heart, that I care dearly for them. And that can bridge that incredible gap between who I am as an older white priest and who they are as a young African-American, a Latino young man growing up in that community.
And I wanted to just talk for just a minute about your process, because you have a drop-in center, and when we're there, we see kids come in and out and hang out and play games and do the things they do. But you also have outreach programs, both of you, one through the Institute for Nonviolence and one through the Precious Blood Ministries. But maybe Sam can talk a little bit about that, because I think that was sort of astounding. You go out into the community, hang out on the corners. How do you find the youth that needs to come in and have help?
And before you answer that, I want to hit the news, because we're going to hit it on time. We come back. Why don't we do that? Why don't we talk about how you do outreach? Because outreach seems to be what's at the center of trying to develop these relationships, as Father Kelly was talking. We're talking about Chicago violence and through the lens of one of Chicago's neighborhoods, Back of the Yards, here on Extension 720 tonight. Stay with us. We're going to be taking your calls and continuing the conversation here on Extension 720. Stay with us. Thanks, David. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. We're talking about Chicago violence and some of the programs that are available to residents and community members in Back of the Yards and around Chicago, because it's not just about Back of the Yards. But the reason we wanted to take a look at this neighborhood in particular is, as Pete played right at the beginning, the newscast items, or that's a lot of times the only time other Chicagoans may hear Back of the Yards, when it's a quick snippet on a newscast about a shooting or some sort of violent crime. And we really wanted to explore the lives of the people that live in Back of the Yards, and also talk about what it's going to take to make gun violence in Chicago go away. I don't know if it ever will, but I think at the end of the day, that's the goal. Sam Castro is here, Director of Programs for the Institute for Nonviolent Chicago. Father David Kelly, Executive Director of the Precious Blood Ministries of Reconciliation. And Sarah Konishnik, who is the organizer for the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence. As Marge just said, Marge Halpern here as well, co-hosting tonight. She had mentioned right before the news about outreach. You know, when you half of the battle is getting to these kids and to community members to provide them services. Sam, we'll start with you. How do you do that? How does the Institute make sure they're doing it the right way?
So for me, I always take 2 points of relentless engagement and harassment. Right? So if they only see us when it's bad time, now they're reluctant to speak to us because they don't know us, right? But if you see us on a continuous base, just a phone call coming through the neighborhoods, checking on them, then it's a relentless engagement piece, because I believe everybody in this room, we always know what's our next meal, what we're gonna buy for them. They don't know. So many times, just picking up a phone call or driving right on the block where they are with their friends, just to see how they're doing, what's on their mind. One-on-one conversations, right? Because I believe when they're in a group with their friends, they got to put up a shield. They got to be tough, right? If not, the streets are going to eat them up. But I've found that when you have these young men in your car, you're like a father figure to them, because they don't got that. So they didn't have that father. They're going to hug the next best thing to them, and it's the street. So when you put them in the car, then it's like, what's up? What's going on? What's on your mind? And they'll tell you, like, I'm going through this, I'm going through that, I'm homeless. And it's hard to believe that at the age of 14, 15, 16 to 19, these kids are homeless. They don't got no place to go. And I say to myself, at 46, I can call anybody and be like, I need somewhere to crash. And they'd be like, come through, Sam, right? So a lot of times, we don't know what they've been through. So it's like, I talk to you today, and I talk to you tomorrow, you done been through a whole ordeal that.
Now, you're from the community, maybe not this one, actually. I don't know whether you grew up in Back of the Yards, but you certainly had a street life as a young man yourself. And you were telling me earlier a story about how, because you know people in the neighborhood, they parents will call you, come talk to my son, and gave me an example that I thought was really clear about how engaged you are with families. When someone called you over to come and talk to her son and friends, and in the end, there was trauma there.
Right. So we had a group of individuals on the west side. I was born and raised on the west side. And their names kept coming up in shootings and shootings. So no one knew really who they were, just a nickname. So I got a phone call from a friend of mine, and he says, hey, that's individual such and such son. So I'm like, hey, wait a minute. I used to run with their father many moons ago when I was the same way. So I found one of them. I ended up going to their house. So I told my boss, listen, I'm going to go by this house for a while. We're going to order some pizza. So when I get to the house, it's like 15 of them, weapons everywhere. They're just smoking and doing what they do, what seems normal to them. So I had my uniform hoodie on. I took it off, and I had to speak to them and let them know I was once you and I understand. So as I was telling them, like, are you going to school? Are you working? They're like, nah, we don't have nothing better to do than shoot, Sam. So I'm like, wait a minute, I can get you a list of things. So I stood there for about 3 hours. When I was done telling them how can I help them, or, you know, just being an ear to listen to them. As I'm exiting out the house, a young man says, Sam, I need a ride. And I'm like, sure, where you going? He says, but I'm armed, and I don't want to put you in harm's way, Sam. And I said, well, thank you, I appreciate it. So about, I drive maybe two blocks, the
you
mother
didn't
calls
take him.
Me.
Yeah, you didn't take him, right.
Right?
Right.
She says, my son just got shot. And I'm like, which one? And she's like, the one that was just leaving with his friends. So I say, where he's at? It was just minutes away. I drove right to the location. I grabbed him. He was hit, flesh wound in his leg. I picked him up, put him in the car, and I'm like, what happened? He says, well, I guess I'm a black male with a hoodie, armed with a firearm. There was another young black male with a hoodie and a gun. Never seen each other's, but as they cross path, in their mind, I gotta shoot you because I don't know who you are. So I'm like, so you never seen him? They were like, never. So you never seen him, you don't have no problem, but you shot at each other. So I'm saying to myself, like, what's the sense of this? So I grabbed them, put them in my car, rushed them to the police. They called the fire department. So for me, as I was telling you guys the other day, that was my buy-in with that group. So I wasn't just the guy that came with the green hoodie to talk about peace.
That's about relationships.
Now, it's that relationship.
You said in there, you know, being able to go in and say, I knew I ran with the dad, and that you knew the lifestyle. What does that mean? Where'd you come from? Talk a little bit about your background and what you used to relate with these kids.
So I was born and raised on the west side. I was shot at the age of three.
Shot at the age of three?
Yes. It was 1976. I was playing on the corner on the west side. There was rival gang shootings. I got shot, and I remember that it was so normal that I grabbed my wrist, walked two doors down to my mom and my grandma, and I just said, Mom, I got shot. I didn't cry till I seen them go crazy. Then they rushed me to my hospital. I remember when I was released, remember seeing my father going into the bathroom, and that's where he kept his gun, and he was like, I'm seeking revenge. So I know what it was. I've done over 17 years in the penitentiary. I made my bad choices. So I understand that some people can read it and take it out of a book, but a lot of these young men and boys, when you tell them you were once them, and then you tell the story, and they're like, wow, so you made it out. I'm like, yeah, I got a couple gunshot wounds and a lot of prison time, but you can make it out also.
So at what point do you realize in that life that you want to change, that you want to opt out, that you want to make a choice in your life that's not a bad choice? Is where do you end up here where you're trying to help others?
I believe after going through so many funerals and close childhood friends being murdered, as I got older, I remember my dad is deceased, and I kept going back to prison back and forth. And one time I came home after doing 7 years for a shooting, my mom said, she handed me a little line she had, and it was my father's, and she said, you've had your ups and downs, but now it's time for you, because you have children, I'm going to hand you this, right? So now it's time for you to be a man and change your life. So just thinking about my kids and not wanting them to go through it, I said, no longer can I be selfish. It's about you guys. But honestly, when we're on the street, we don't care about not ourselves. But if you ask me and anybody else that was living that life, we cared about our mom, grandparents, and kids. So I think it took a lot of, where I was left with no more tears and the heart couldn't take it no more. And I said, it's been about 30 years. We can't win. So I give up.
As you see Chicago and all of what comes with Chicago gun violence today, and see the politicians talking about it and talking, and the police and everybody else wanting to solve this scourge, for someone who's lived it, what do you say? What do you say to people that we don't understand, that we don't understand about what pushes and what gun violence is?
I think in order for us to start helping them change the way their mind thinks and to win their hearts, we got to give them something. What's the dangling carrot? Right, I could talk about peace all day long, but if we're not talking about economics and try to help them get out, they're like, Sam, I got to. You could come here and talk about peace, but if I can't feed my family, this is the only way I know. Right? So I've seen, working with the youth, many of them don't know how to read or write. So it's sad that I come talk to you and say, well, let's go get your ID. Some young kids will tell you, I don't need an ID, I know who I am. So it's just the resources. Like, I could come and talk about peace all day long, but if I don't have something to change, they're going to be like, Sam, you're going to leave up the street, but I'm going to leave right here, and I got to do something.
Sam Castro, Director of Programs with the Institute for Nonviolence in Chicago. Also, Sarah Konishnik is here. She's the organizer for the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence. And Father David Kelly is the Executive Director of Precious Blood Ministries of Reconciliation. Marge Halpern, of course, my co-host tonight, as we talk about Chicago's gun violence and also about Back of the Yards. When we come back, I want to play the clip from Anthony, who shows in this just two-minute clip where he talks about his life. You see a lot of the contrasts and the complexities that kids growing up in neighborhoods like Back of the Yards are going through. We'll have that coming up here on Extension 720, so stay with us. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. A special program tonight as we're talking about Chicago violence and using the neighborhood of Back of the Yards as the lens to really explore Chicago violence, because as we're talking about tonight with our panel, with Marge Halpern and others here, it's a complex issue, and there's a lot that goes on, and you see that when we sort of paint broad strokes and talk about people, as we know, as we heard early in the newscast, just only knowing one neighborhood for its violence, you don't know the whole story. In studio with me tonight, Father David Kelly, Executive Director of the Precious Blood Ministries of Reconciliation, which is set up shop in an old elementary school right at 51st and Troop. Sam Castro, Outreach Program Manager at the Institute for Nonviolent Chicago, and Sarah Konishnik, who is the organizer for the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence. I promised Anthony here. This is one of the kids we heard, Anthony Rojas. He was in the early part of the show. If you heard us, we did the montage of the kids talking about their lives. And Anthony, he had a quote, and we didn't use it in the montage, but I was just kind of going through my head today, listening back to this, and it kind of sets up what we're talking about here, the complexities. So let me play. He's talking about what Anthony's talking about right here at the beginning is about how why he goes to the Institute, why he's at Precious Blood, just this idea of what they do to make his life better. So let's hear it from Anthony.
I come back for joy. It's fun. You know, we do stuff with our friends that we can't do in the neighborhood. Like, we always tend to look back and stuff, but when we go to these programs, like we went to the wilderness, it was fun. We did stuff like we ain't do before. We seen stuff we ain't do. You feel me? We saw stars, because there ain't no more stars over here, so just like lay down,
told each other how much we meant to each other. Just like little stuff that meant a lot that we want to forget about.
How old are you?
I'm 17 now.
17 years old. You grew up in the back of the yards?
Yeah, my whole life.
So for people who don't live in the neighborhood and they're trying to get a better understanding listening to this right now about what life is like, when you say you're looking behind you, what does that mean?
Like, just to make sure I'm good, you know? Nobody come behind me, try to kill me or anything like that.
Try and kill you?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a thing.
Yeah, that's the thing nowadays. People just, you know, broke people, they don't got time to look for a job. Or, I mean, they don't want a job. They'd rather just go out there and I don't know. I think about it sometimes, but that shit's over. I just rather, you feel me, get a job, because at the end of the day, if you get caught doing something stupid, you could spend the rest of your life behind bars, you know?
Yeah, Anthony Rojas there is 17 years old. And the reason I played that is he starts that clip, Marge, talking about the joy.
Joy is one
that
he pulls
out of what he gets from the Institute and the idea that he can go out into the wilderness and see stars. There's no stars left in back of the yards. And he goes on to talk about some of the fear that he feels every day, and then makes a transition into maybe I should rob. Maybe I need to do that. All the complexities of being a teenager and being someone who's 17 years old, Father Kelly, living in back of the yards is on display there.
Yeah, one of the things we can't forget is they're kids. And so as much as they may be doing adult-like things, they are kids, and they think like kids. They don't think clearly. If anybody knows a 14, 15-year-old kid, you know, they're by definition...
all over the place.
I better not say what I was going to say.
It's
hard to deal with
you.
Sometimes. But here's what I believe wholeheartedly. So Anthony and the rest of them that you interviewed, and almost every kid in our neighborhood at 15, 14, 13, whatever, all know someone who is harmed. They have a loved one who was killed. Gun violence is in their family. They get that. They know that they're vulnerable. I don't know how old I was before I even thought about that. So they're growing up knowing people that they love, that they looked up to, who have been harmed. And they know that it's dangerous in the neighborhood. They know that if just going from our center to the park, which is less than a block away, they have to, as Anthony said, watch his back. They're constantly on guard, and that is exhausting. Constantly looking over the shoulder. Constantly just watching out for themselves going a block or two. And the third thing that I think is indicting on us, really, is the availability of guns. Mm. So you have 14-year-olds that know they're vulnerable, 14-year-olds that know that they're in a dangerous place, and the availability of guns. And so you have so much gun violence going on in these communities. And so as a society, as Sarah's dedicated her waking hours to, and maybe some of her sleeping hours to, we have to get guns off the streets.
Right.
But we also have to deal with the trauma in the lives of our young people. You know, the little old adage, hurt people hurt people. And so at Precious Blood, and I think the Institute as well, that together we really try to focus on these young people and their families, which is a critical part of this, and to really provide the support and the care, the relationship, and the resources. So that's the part Sam was talking about. It's good to talk about peace. That's good. Nice. You know, preachers preach. But we have to back that up with some real resources.
Right.
You've got to give them something.
Sarah, when you hear that, and you hear Anthony, and even this idea that maybe he needs to go to a life of crime, and you hear what Father Kelly saying about the prevalence of guns, you know, a 13-year-old, 14-year-old, these are the kids that are getting the illegal guns.
Well, what I think of when I hear those stories and those comments is that the entire city as a whole, we're all failing to act responsibly to address a lot of these problems. So as Father Kelly said, you know, what I focus on is trying to get guns off the street. Well, I do that through trying to get people at the grassroots level active in supporting their legislators to not just pass policy changes, but also get people at the grassroots level engaged in building relationships with people in these communities, because what so often happens is people in communities like Lincoln Park, people in communities like, you know, Oak Park, Hinsdale, Libertyville, where I live, we think this problem doesn't have anything to do with us. We don't see the people who live in these communities as part of us. And you know, a lot of us have really big hearts and we want to help, and we might read a really great article and we might send some money. We might donate some money to Precious Blood Ministry of Institute for Nonviolence Chicago because we read some fabulous article, or hear a radio program like this and think, well, I really want to help. And that is great, and people should donate at any chance that they can and to any extent that they can. But, you know, we've been donating people from fully served communities. We've been donating our money for decades, right? What we need is a completely new level of engagement based on relationship building. And the truth is, what I do for the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence is I organize the Illinois Gun Violence Prevention Coalition, which is 185 member organizations across the state working to reduce every type of gun violence in every type of community by getting people connected among and between communities. So the reason that's so important is because we have to actually be in each other's spaces mm-hmm. in order to care enough to take our activism beyond just maybe making some donations a couple of times a year to really taking action, which hopefully later tonight I can share some
ways absolutely
to take action.
Sarah Kanishnik is the organizer for the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence. We also heard from Father David Kelly, executive director of the Precious Blood Ministries of Reconciliation. And Sam Castro is here as well from the Institute for Nonviolence Chicago. All right, we'll take a break so we can get to the news. We come back, we'll talk about some of the work Sister Donna has been doing at Precious Blood with women in back of the yards, young mothers, and they've lost their sons to violence, and they've also lost their son to incarceration. There's a lot of powerful stories coming up here on Extension 720 that we've collected from back of the yards this summer. It is Extension 720. I'm Justin Kaufman, and we will return in just a moment here on 720 WGN. The phone number, 312-981-7200 here on Extension 720, here on 720 WGN, our special program tonight, talking about Chicago violence, some of the solutions, and the people who are trying to come up with solutions for Chicago violence. We're also talking to some of the communities affected. In this case, we're talking to residents in back of the yards. Coming up, we're going to talk to women who rarely get talked about when it comes to Chicago violence, but the women that, young mothers and women who have violence in their lives. We'll talk about those stories, coming up on this very special Extension 720. All right. Thank you, David. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN with you till 10 o'clock tonight. I'm Justin Kaufman. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Well, we're exploring the issues surrounding Chicago gun violence on the program tonight. In the first hour, we talked mainly about the teenagers that are in both programs and back of the yards. But now let's turn to women, young mothers to be exact. Across from the old elementary school is a brick two flat. It used to be a drug house, but now it serves as a home for the women's program at Precious Blood, run by Sister Donna Liette. Sister Donna invites young moms who have lost children to both violence and prison to come in and be part of her community, to be part of her peace circles, to share their stories. She tends a garden, and the inside walls are painted by artists from the community. It's a major initiative to remember the women, not just the men, who are living with violence in their lives every day. We'll hear from Sister Donna coming up. But first, let's hear from some of the women who attend the circles in their own words.
You know, bullet doesn't have a name on it, so you know, you don't know when you're going to die, you don't know when it's your time. So I just try to, I don't go out outside a lot because it's kids out here dying just playing in the park. I want to make memories with them, like taking them out to the park and to the zoo for ice cream, and I can't really do that while like having anxiety on my shoulder, like, okay, I gotta look over here and say, okay, is this safe? Is this car gonna shoot out or let the window down with bullets out flying? You know, every single day the anxiety just get worse because every time I turn on the news, it's something new. It's another little kid that died over gun violence for no reason.
My life personally, well, it's made a direct hit in it. I actually just had a best friend who was killed in June due to the violence in the community. She was dealing with a partner who was wrapped up in some pretty heavy stuff, and it resulted in her death. So I feel the direct weight of it. Since I've even been here at Precious Blood, we've lost two of our own participants. So within a year that I've been here, I've attended funerals.
I have a son that was incarcerated for 6 years for armed robbery. So the police came over to to come pick him up, and I said, why are you taking my son? They wouldn't tell me, so they said that he'll be back in the next couple of days, but that never happened. I missed him every day that he wasn't in the house, so that affected me very much.
Did you know he was in that kind of trouble, or was it all a surprise?
I knew he was always in trouble. I could feel it because I'm a mom. I feel for the mothers that lost their children to gun violence. It really hurts. I just wish, you know, we could do more for them.
Do you worry at all about violence in your life?
Yeah, I do. When I be hearing about the, you know, gun violence and girls getting, you know, snatched and girls, stuff happening to girls and stuff happening to babies, it scared me a little bit. They just act like we're nobody. They don't really help us as much they help, you know, the guys. So we don't get as much help, or our stories don't really come out or go on the news like, you know, when it be happening to men's. Stuff can happen any day in the blink of an eye. You wouldn't know.
Hmm. Those are the voices of Charisma Curtis, Christine Abreu, Markeisha Buchanan, and Carlin Francoise, all part of the women's program at Precious Blood Ministries of Reconciliation in Back of the Yards. We're going to talk with Sister Donna coming up here, play a little tape from our conversation with her. In studio tonight, Father David Kelly is executive director over at Precious Blood Ministries, Sam Castro with the Institute for Nonviolent Chicago, and Sarah Kanishnik, organizer for the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence, and Marge Halperin. We sat down and talked to these women. We didn't play all the interviews we did, but it's amazing to hear them talk about their lives and recognize that, you know, I don't hear a lot about violence when it comes to women in that community.
You don't. And certainly women are victims of violence, but they're also the ones who put the family back together when anyone suffers from violence in the family. I think one of the things that struck me from the beginning as we had these conversations is the peace circles you talked about. Women come together. There are women who lost their sons, and it is usually sons, victims of violence, but they're also mothers of perpetrators of violence, and there are ways that they come together. And Father Kelly, to me, this is part of the restorative justice piece, that there's a level on which everyone is suffering, and it doesn't have to be my suffering's worse than yours, or you have to pay because you hurt my son. There's a lot of pain to go around. And I'd love to hear you talk some about the restorative justice approach to healing when the wounds are so deep.
Yeah, restorative justice is a philosophy. A lot of people like to make it out to be a program, but it's a philosophy. It's a mindset of really appreciating what's behind some of the issues. So the reason I might show up is because my son was killed. Or I might show up because my son was incarcerated or is incarcerated. And once you get beyond those labels and people start to tell their story and really engage with one another, what the mothers and others discover is that there's a level of commonality in who we are and where we are at. You know, they say that we're at our closest, most intimate in our suffering. And I think what mothers discover in one another is you too are a mother that is hurt. You too are a mother that no longer can reach out and touch her son, whether that son be in the grave or whether that son be behind bars. And that's where they come together, and that's where they support one another. And I've been privileged to witness incredible laughter and joy and moments later tears, and because they're really connecting with one another at a deep, deep level. And that's where healing happens.
Yeah.
When you get beyond the issues or the labels, society tends to separate them and really see them as adversarial and an adversarial relationships. But in reality, when you create those spaces and places that a peacemaking circle will allow you to do, and you attend to the relationships and the stories, what happens is incredible.
And Sam, deep. Go ahead.
And deep.
Deep.
They can
yes.
touch each other in a place where it really matters.
Mm-hmm. Sam, and lean on one another. you know, they really do lean on one another, and they care for one another, which is incredible.
You mentioned, Sam, just in talking about your story and trying to connect and relate to the kids, that there aren't a lot of father figures. And you, a lot of times with outreach, it might be the moms that are reaching out saying, I need you to step in here. I need you to help me with my son, or I need something. How often do you have to develop your relationships with the moms to get to the kids?
That's a good question, because actually a lot of time they have no father. So sometimes it's women in the community that we know, or we know someone that knows them, or a relative. And many times we get these calls all throughout the days or nights, and they'll be like, we heard of the program and what you're doing. I need help. I got two boys. They're in the street. What can you do to help me, right? So that's those moments where we have to take advantage of that call and get there fast. Because we know as outreach worker, it's like we're doctors, so everything is critical. That minute, if I miss the beat, I can lose another life. So we got to go and see what the mom knows, because a lot of times the mom's going to know one part of the story. And it's just crazy to think that some mothers will say, my boys are good. They're not into nothing. So then once the mom makes introduction and we go get something to eat and we talk, and you'll be surprised what the boy says, right? Mm-hmm. So the story changes.
Right, right.
Or it's a mom like one of the ones that we talked to, Christina Abreu, who said, yeah, I knew. It's they know deep inside, but they really don't want to recognize that. You want to be more hopeful.
Right, and no matter what, they're still a mom.
That's right.
So what can you tell a mom, right? No matter if she knows, well, I've seen my son with a gun. It's still, that's your baby.
Coming up here, I got a conversation with Sister Donna Liette, who will we talked with her in her office, her house, her home, the home that she works out of at 51st and Troop. We're talking about the Back of the Yards neighborhood in Chicago violence tonight, 312-981-7200, if you'd like to contribute to the conversation. We'll take a break here, and we'll come back, and we'll hear from Sister Donna Liette here on Extension 720. Stay with us. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're talking about Chicago violence and some of the organizations in Back of the Yards that are trying to make a difference. Marge, our next guest in this tape that we did the interview down at Precious Blood Ministries in the Women and Families Program's home, Sister Donna Liette. This, how did you first meet Sister Donna? Because it's obvious that she's kind of a Chicago celebrity at this point. She seems to be everywhere. But the idea that she does so much for this community.
She really does. And I had been at Precious Blood for a peace march that you did in the spring, and met several folks then. But after I left, a friend of mine said, did you meet Sister Donna? I'm like, no. Oh, my God, you have to go back. Sister Donna's real deal. And you only have to listen to her for about 60 seconds to know that's true.
Well, we talked to her just about her life and why she does it and why it's important for women in Back of the Yards. Here's a snippet of the conversation with Sister Donna.
I feel that a lot, too, that we don't really look at the women's role in the community and the powerful voices that they have, but very seldom, most of the time, are silenced, whether it's in the courtroom or in social services. You know, often we have to be a voice for them. But what we try to do here is try to empower them and to give them a voice. And when they sit together in circle, perhaps especially, you know, when they were at the table to tell their stories and hear one another's stories, they empower each other, they bond together, and they feel, yes, we could speak out. You know, we no longer need to be isolated. That's what I try to bring the women out of, feeling after their sons perhaps have caused violence in the community, they want to isolate, they feel shame, they feel guilt often, and so they isolate. And so we're saying, you know, maintain your voice, you know, and not put blame upon yourself. You know, let's just tell the story and get our truth out. And then the women whose sons have been murdered and lives have been taken, you know, there's another whole part of that emotion. You know, again, sometimes they feel guilt. Sometimes they feel, you know, no one wants to hear their story. Oh, you'll get over it. A lot of times our mothers hear that. You'll get over it. And so we want to tell them, you don't need to get over it. This is a very horrible tragedy, and it's a very traumatic experience. There's a lot of trauma behind all that. So
I came to a peace march here earlier in the spring, mm-hmm. and there were a lot of women there. Many would carry pictures of the child they'd lost mm-hmm. to violence. Mm-hmm. Is that part of being able to recognize what happened? Is that something that you advocate, that continually talking about the loss?
Yes, it's really very important, because, you know, sometimes there's a lot of talk right at the time of the homicide, but once the funeral is over, the wake, the homecoming, whatever they call it in their own traditions, you know, most people go, in any, you know, whoever experiences death, you know, it's the afterwards. You know, everybody goes home, and then you're left with that pain and sorrow, and you don't know what to do with it. One. It's always hard to talk about it. But one of the mothers said, you know, she just sits and looks out the window. You know, until I called her and said, you know, you want me to come to your home, or you want to come here? And finally she did come here, but she said, all day long I just sit and look out the window and think maybe he'll come home, you know. So those are the hard things, and a lot of the women go through that.
You bring the mothers together in a circle, and to be clear, mm-hmm. they come together whether their children were lost to violence or caused violence. What is that dynamic like?
So the dynamics of that, though, so first it was just women who lost children to the prison system. They had caused harm in the community, and often it was, you know, a murder. And so one day a mother walked into our center, and her son had been murdered. And so we worked through all of that for a while, and then I said, you know, we have a woman's group. Most of these have lost children to the prison system, but you'd be welcome. And she said, well, okay, I'll come. And so she came the first time, and then said afterwards, I don't think I belong here. And I said, well, why don't you try it one more time? So she came back one more time. Her name is Tamika. And as she was talking in the circle about, you know, the only way that she can be any way present to her son, you know, who was murdered, was go to the gravesite and, you know, walk away, cannot bring him home, and is never at any, you know, celebrations of birthdays, Christmas, and so forth. And as the circle went around, another mother, whose child had been incarcerated since he was 15 and was to die in prison because of the law that any double homicide, a juvenile was mandatorily sentenced to life in prison without parole. So she told her story, and not in trying to argue or anything, you know, against this woman's story, you know, or say hers was worse, but she just told her story and how it was to travel 6 hours, you know, one way, then have to get, you know, hotel, and then if you wanted to visit another 2 hours the next day, and then, you know, you walked away too, and she couldn't bring him home, and he would never be home either for Christmas, or, and you know, just talking about that, and all of a sudden, these two moms just connected, and they said, you know, we've both lost, and they just embraced and said, you know, we're hurting. We have the same kind of pain for a different reason, but we're still hurting women. We still need to work together and bond together. So, yeah, that's kind of how that works.
You have such a, and my last question for you, but just your vantage point of where you sit in this office right at in back of the yards right here on 51st Street, to experience the stories of Chicago's violence through the women and the mothers and all the stories of people who've lost, not being from here, being from Dayton, do you see it a different way than the rest of the city sees it, that the press sees it, that others sort of understand Chicago's problem with violence?
Well, I think probably one of the things that bothers me, I think it becomes kind of a normal, and the city just thinks this is who we are, you know. And I talked to one of our boys one day, and he had just witnessed his best friend was shot and killed. And then about a year later, I guess, another friend of his was shot and killed right in front of his home. And I said, Tommy, how do you deal with all this? And he said, oh, you just get used to it. And I said, Tommy, no, this isn't a thing you should get used to. You know, so I think maybe I see it a little bit differently like that, that when I came into this city, I mean, I saw quite a bit in Dayton, Ohio, especially working with women who are very addicted to heroin and trying to recover from that. There still was a lot of pain in that, too. But it seemed like they didn't feel like this is normal. This is, we could work ourselves out of this life. And a lot of them, you know, have had now 26, 27 years clean, you know. So, but here sometime, that's why I hold on to hope, because I think, is there really hope here? You know, and if we aren't people here at Precious Blood Ministry of Reconciliation that carry that hope, you know, where will they find it?
Mm. Sister Donna Liette is the coordinator of Women and Family Programs at Precious Blood Ministries of Reconciliation in Back of the Yards. We're talking about the violence in Chicago in Back of the Yards, but also its impact on women in this hour. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. We got much more in this program coming up. We're going to talk about mentors, what they go through, and also just how, and Sister Donna talks about this too, and we're going to talk a little bit more with some of the stuff she has coming up, how they deal with the trauma. All that coming up on Extension 720, so stay with us. Thank you, David. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and we are talking about Chicago violence tonight on Extension 720. We're talking with a panel in studio, but also with members of the Back of the Yards community that we had a chance to interview and meet by going down. Marge Halpern and I, along with Pete Zimmerman, were able to go down to Back of the Yards this summer and talk to some residents about what they think about Chicago violence and living with that every single day. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Let me reset the panel for everybody so we know who's in studio with us. Father David Kelly is the executive director of the Precious Blood Ministries of Reconciliation, which is right there at 51st and Troop. Sam Castro is outreach program manager with the Institute for Nonviolence Chicago, which is right there as well. And Sarah Konishnik is the organizer for the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence. And Marge Halpern's here as well. And we're talking about, there's, you know, as Marge mentioned about restorative justice, I want to come back to that. We heard Sister Donna talking about peace circles and getting women who both have lost family members and sons, but also women who have lost sons to incarceration together in one room. Where does this principle come from? You said it's a philosophy, not a program. And you see this more and more being used in not only our policing and schools and in the courts. How do you use restorative justice?
So restorative justice is a philosophy. It's one of when there is a harm or when there's a conflict or when there's trauma, that you address the trauma, you address the harm versus who did it and how do we punish that person. So it's really focused on the victim, focused on the one who has been harmed, and then it's incumbent upon the one who caused the harm and the community to kind of work to restore or to repair or somehow help the healing of that harm. So it's completely different than what we have in our criminal justice system that focuses on a law that was broken, who broke the law, and how do we punish. Restorative justice says, what was the harm done? Who was hurt? How do we help repair that harm? And then who helps repair that harm? And who's to be held accountable for that? So a peacemaking circles is a practice of that kind of thinking. And so it's a ritualized, values-based gathering of folks using talking pieces, sacred items, creating an area that is really reflective of who's in that circle, and then dealing with one another, the relationships, and then ultimately you might be dealing with an issue that needs to be solved by the community. It's an indigenous kind of thinking. It goes back to before we could dial 911 and have anything taken care of, where elders had to gather and really wrestle with what they needed to do in their community in order to deal with whatever the issue might be in the community.
No, obviously there's a need for that because of the trauma that are in the communities. But, Sam, it's not going to replace the criminal justice system. So how do you keep kids – how do you get kids involved in restorative justice and those kind of programs, but at the same time – keep them off the streets?
So giving them a different alternative, right? Helping them change the way they think and helping them. Sometimes they don't have the right idea or the right choice. So we got to kind of like during the conversation, put it in there, slide it in somehow, some way. And then they'll be like, that'll work. So example for a lot of the clients that we work with, We do a system and we go support them in case they have cases at the courthouse. We'll go with them in case that they've made it that far. Just the continuously engaging the young men, right? Mm-hmm. To let them know, like, it's not only if you go and commit a crime, taking someone's life, but it's also going to jail. It's a lose-lose situation.
Yeah. There's so much, when it comes to... And Sarah, I'd like to bring you in on this. When you see how our government has attempted to deal with whether violence, and mostly when it comes to guns, and you see mandatory minimums, and you see the police saying that it's all about bond reform, or it may be, or the mayor saying it's all about bond reform. There seems to be, you know, a push to try and get those elements and control, because those are the only things they can control.
I'd like to throw in one thing. Another thing the mayor can control is the amount of money they spend on programs like this to help communities. And I know there's a great deal of interest in getting some increased funding, because Mayor Lightfoot's about to announce a new budget. And those who work in the community would like to see some direct funding for some of the peace work that's being done by these organizations and others.
Yeah, I think what Sam and Father Kelly were touching on, and what you just touched on now, Justin, is the way... like I said earlier in the program, those of us who don't live in these and work in these underserved communities, we've really sort of abdicated our responsibility for the people that share this city with us. And it's much easier to say, okay, it's someone else's job to discipline, to impose some sort of punitive action or solution in order to solve this problem. It's just easier to put it in the hands of the criminal justice system. That's how we've abdicated our responsibility. And everything that I do in organizing the coalition, which I, like I said, is 185 member organizations from different types of communities, has been inspired really by the Precious Blood Ministry model of restorative justice.
Mm-hmm.
Precious Blood Ministry of Reconciliation is one of nine restorative justice organizations that constitute something called Communities Partnering for Peace. And when I first got involved in this work, I learned about that CP4P, Communities Partnering for Peace model, and how by coming together, those restorative justice organizations are tearing down the silos that have existed in this space. I mean, I really felt so that communities like Institute for Nonviolence Chicago and Precious Blood Ministry are working together to resolve the problem. And that really inspired me to try to run the coalition the way I have organized it, because I feel like that same idea needs to be applied not just within the community where this everyday gun violence is occurring, but between communities here throughout the city. That's where we have a role to play. Those of us that live in fully served parts of the city of Chicago, our role is to take action. And we can do that by supporting organizations within the CP4P collaborative organization, and other organizations throughout the city who are working to address this problem. In fact, we are having a kickoff event on Monday evening at Chicago Sinai Congregation at 15 West Delaware Place in Chicago from 6 to 7:30 p.m. This is our kickoff event for the Fund Peace for Chicago campaign. And what we're doing is we're trying to leverage the Illinois Gun Violence Prevention Coalition and its member organizations to call on the city government to fully fund the mayor's office of gun violence prevention.
And that's going to be a big thing, is the new mayor's office of gun violence prevention. Okay, here's the question I have about restorative justice.
Okay.
When you talk about, you hear the kids talk, and we hear Sam talk, and just kind of get the vibe about how, what street life is like. When you say the community is responsible for the community, how do you wrestle that responsibility away from street gangs, from others who may be the ones that are actually calling the shots? Meaning, if you say that, you know what, the harm is made, here's the trauma, all that kind of stuff, they're not being punished. They continue to wreak havoc on communities. They continue to be the sort of thorn in the side of trying to find peace in these neighborhoods. So how do you, as the Institute of Nonviolence and Precious Blood Ministries, engage gangs or deal with gangs?
So that kind of thinking maybe 30 years ago that it was valid. Today, gangs, and it's a little different than African-American gangs and Latino gangs. We can talk a little bit about that. But it's not this entity that we're fighting against. The young people that you heard on the earlier in the segment, some of their older brothers are in gangs. Some of them might be kind of getting close to being gangs. So it's because you grew up on 51st and Laughlin that all of a sudden you're pegged now as a gang member. You might not have done anything different than the kid that's grew up in the North Side, but you're pegged that because of where you come from. So it's not this entity. It's really about interpersonal violence, interpersonal trauma that's going on. And so you might have said something to me, and Sam alluded to it earlier about, you know, two people shot each other and didn't even know each other. They didn't know what gang they were in. They just we other one another. So restorative justice is about really helping us to see beyond those kinds of things and get to know each other as a human person. You know, I've done some circles where kids come in different part of the neighborhoods, and in the beginning, but I knew them because I'm a chaplain at Cook County Juvenile, and so I got to know them there, and so that was my inroad to invite them into the circle, even though they were from different gangs, different parts of the community. And they were able, once we started talking about who we were and what was important to us, to get beyond those labels and see each other as a human person. And that's what we're doing, not only for our young people, but also, Sarah alluded to Communities Partnering for Peace, those of us working in this area. Communities Partnering for Peace is based on the knowledge, the understanding that we need each other. So the Institute for Nonviolence does outreach. And they partner with us, Precious Blood Ministry of Reconciliation, that does the case management. And yet another organization within our community does what we call Light in the Night, this outreach into the community to build the fabric of community where folks are coming out. And together, that's kind of the model of CP4P. Outreach, building relationships relentlessly, creating ways where these young people can come into the community, to the organization, and through radical hospitality, letting them believe that this is space is their space. And then out of those relationships, then they say, Kelly, I need a job. And so we put together programs and resources in order to get that young person a job. And so that's kind of the model that we have.
This is sort of what I was addressing at the top of the show. This is the difference between what happened 30 years ago when there were bigger forces that layered on the community and what's happening today that's coming from within the community and has much more resonance and much more impact and more understanding and more ability to make changes because you have the relationships, because your organizations are run by and staffed by people who have had these experiences. And the gangs are out there. The police are out there, too, and the guns are out there, and all the different forces happening at a larger level. But on the ground, what Father Kelly just described is what's impacting lives one at a time.
Well, that seems to be remarkable. The approach. So let's do this. Take a break. But I want to come back to it because I do think that we should still talk about guns and we should still talk about gangs and we should still talk about police. We haven't talked about the police. We saw a lot of, and some of the texters that are texting in talking about the relationship or with police and how you guys relate to them, but also how the community. We've seen over and over, and we've seen it from our perch and reading on the news just about the no snitch policies in communities. We'll talk about that relationship and that trust coming up here as we talk about Chicago Violence, a special program tonight on Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman. We're talking about Chicago Violence and Back of the Yards. Marge Helprin is here, longtime TV and radio analyst, and also a board member with Indivisible Chicago, which is a great organization. So, you know, we're continuing this conversation, so give us a ring, 312-981-7200. We're going to talk more about mentorship and also about all the things we just talked about, gangs, police, and guns, of course, all those things that are coming up here.
When we talked about gangs, in some ways, we were just a little bit dismissive in that, you know, they're out there and they're going to operate in various ways. You may not be able to keep kids from being enticed by gangs. But I know, Sam, that you also do work directly with the gangs, and you've had some remarkable success in, if you can't get the guns off the street, sometimes you can get them to stop using the guns.
So the approach we took, we have two different groups in the Back of the Yards who've been rival members for over 30 years. One lieutenant from the 9th District said one of the young men was gunned down with an assault rifle. He was shot 21 times. Mm. Nobody went to jail. So this is what they seen. Was just assault rifles attack. So what we did through outreach, we grabbed some of the youth that was in the community and we started talking to them. So the Institute hired them as outreach workers. So they was our way to break into the group. So it's kind of hard to speak to guys about a peace treaty when there's been bad blood between both groups.
For years, yeah.
For years, right? Mm-hmm. And it's just embedded. It comes with your book bag, and that's what you take to school. This is a number two, and this is what it is. So what we did was we spoke to them and saying, well, what would a ceasefire look like in between you and your adversaries? So at first they were like, well, the other group wouldn't go for it. There's no way possible. It's too much bad blood. So our thought was just to create a doubt or say, hey, well, if they would go for it, would you go for it? So after speaking to them, the continuous engagement, going out bowling, whatever it was to kind of break the silence between us, finally the guy says, you know what? We're willing to give it a shot. If Group A will be willing to give it a shot. So we went with our other co-workers to the adversary neighborhood, and we got to telling them the same thing. So of course the machismo sticks out and says, oh, we would do it, but we're not sure they will, right? Because it's too much bad blood. And one of my co-workers and myself say, if they're willing, would you be willing? So he goes, I would, but they'll never do it. And we say, well, guess what, they're willing. So we tried it. It went on for 7 weeks. And there was a homicide. After that, they retaliated. It was another homicide.
Hmm.
So when the guy was arrested, he told his guys, hey, he says, I've been working with the Institute for Nonviolence on this kind of thing. We made a bad choice. We ended up in jail for homicide. I want you guys to go back to the table and speak about it again. So actually, the anniversary is this Saturday. It's been 1 year.
Wow.
Since there's been no shooting and homicides. And this is also the area where in May of 2018, they had a DA that was shot. So nobody talks about the success of this, where now you go into the two areas and the gang members are walking in the park. The community is enjoying. And it's funny because they'll tell us, like, thank you for what you did. And we're like, we didn't do it. This was you.
You
chose that. We was just a piece to go back and forth and make this happen for you guys.
There's so much to unpack with that, just about how you break through. And obviously, it's really just about the relationships once again. And you know, to hear that story and to think about what you said, that people are born into their affiliation now. We have, you know, I forgot what at the beginning, something. Something by association by affiliation. But how do you do that? If somebody is at 51st and Laughlin and they grew up on that block and they know a couple blocks over that, you know, you've had this rivalry. I mean, do you have to go block by block in the city? I mean, is that the best way we can do this? Is the success you've had in the ceasefire for a year, is that just have to be turned over and turned over and turned over until we eradicate this problem?
In a lot of ways, it does. We've got to build relationships. And the unique thing about Precious Blood is that young people who are in these gangs come from Precious Blood. Every day, there's young people who are in that space, in that place. And so we build these relationships. They're coming from some of the blocks that we're talking about. But one of the things that Sam said, I think, that's really critical, too, is that the outreach team not only said, you know, stop the shooting and help them facilitate that, but they said, what do you need? And they talked about parks. They talked about speed bumps. They talked about things that would enhance their ability and allow their children to come out. And so the other part of that is the Institute and others, we responded to their needs. So we listened to them. We validated what their concerns were. It wasn't a one-way street. And I think that's how you deal with block by block or corner by corner, is that you listen to their needs and then you respond.
A texter points out, just saying, you know, why not deal with gangs the same way you deal with mobs? Or the mob. This idea that, you know, you if there's going to be a shooting, you go in and you clean out the mob. But this is, they're not listening to the point that there are no gangs. These are just blocks. And these are kids. Police can't go in and know exactly who's with what area. It's based on something entirely different than what it was based on before.
And it's kids. It's not the mob. It's kids finding a way in their communities to get by, given the structure that they live in. It's really not what we're talking about.
But it's also a symptom. I mean, everybody wants to belong somewhere. And so because our society and our families are struggling and stressed out, young people find themselves outside the house more. And when you get outside the house, you start to affiliate with people kind of like you and that think the kind of like you. And all of a sudden, that may develop into a clique or a gang or whatever you want to call it. And one of the things we have to do is help our community stabilize. And some of the work that we're doing, the Institute for Nonviolence, Precious Blood, Back of the Yards Neighborhood Council, and the whole community is to really, and that's what Sisters Donna is doing, getting into those families, really alleviating some of the stress and strain that they have somebody to lean on.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, the family can start to kind of function in a better kind of way. And that young person doesn't find like, damn, I got to leave this house. You know, it's too toxic here. The family's starting to be healed a little bit, and that young person might find some peace and quiet within that family.
Talking Chicago violence and some of the ideas that are on the table when we talk of restorative justice and how we approach this issue in the city, Father David Kelly, Sam Castro, Sarah Kanishnik are here, Marge Halperin as well. We'll take our break. We'll get to the news. We come back. Let's hear some more from people who live and work in Back of the Yards and also continue this conversation. We have yet to talk about relationship with the police. That's going to be coming up here in the 9 o'clock hour on Extension 720. Stay with us. Extension 720 rolling along here at 720 WGN, a special program tonight talking about Chicago violence and some of the solutions and ideas that are on the table as we talk about all the components and all the people that are involved. Tonight we have the conversation through the lens of Back of the Yards, which is a neighborhood in Chicago that has seen its share of violence. We continue our conversation and hear more from people who live with violence every day in Back of the Yards coming up here in just a moment after David Jennings news here on 720 WGN. So stay with us. All right. Thanks, David. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and we are doing a special program tonight talking about Chicago violence. We've got a great panel in studio, and we're hearing tape from some interviews we did in Back of the Yards is we're really looking at that Chicago neighborhood when we talk about Chicago violence. We have a whole panel in studio. I want to reintroduce them here for the 9 o'clock hour. Father David Kelly, Executive Director of the Precious Blood Ministries of Reconciliation. Sam Castro, Outreach Program Manager with the Institute for Nonviolence Chicago. Sarah Kanishnik is the organizer for the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence. And Marge Halperin is our co-host tonight here on 720 WGN. Before we get to more stories from Back of the Yards, because we want to talk about some of the mentors, but also some of the... And there's a couple of really powerful stories about how the people who work for your organizations deal with trauma themselves. I mean, they're hearing these stories over and over and over. We're going to get to that coming up here. But, you know, I wanted to stay with the relationship with the police because I thought it was startling. In the interviews we did in Back of the Yards with the teenagers, with the moms, with everybody involved, the police did not get brought up. It was not what you would stereotypically think that someone would say, I have a problem with the law or I don't have a good relationship with the police. Even they just didn't really talk about it. What's the police's relationship with you guys, but also with restorative justice and the concept of what you're trying to do to build community? Father Kelly?
So one of the values of restorative justice is this, in our organizations, as CP for P, Communities Partnering for Peace, is relentless engagement of young people and families. So really just being there. But it's also relentless engagement of stakeholders and systems, which includes the police. And so it really does us no good if we're in an adversarial relationship with
right,
the police.
Right.
It's I'm too old for that. I'm too tired to do that. And so what we have to do is really work with the police where we can. And I think there are a lot of ways in which we can partner once we get to know each other. And once police start to value the street outreach workers and see them not as a problem but as a solution. And I think also that the street outreach workers and the folks that are working in our programs see the police not as the problem or as the enemy,
right,
but maybe an ally in some ways. But you have to be real careful that everybody has got their roles and that they're not mixed up. So the police can't lean on outreach workers to give up information, for example, because one of the greatest things about an outreach worker is the trust that they have with the community.
Sam, you mentioned relationships and how you use them, but when it comes to the police, the relationship with the community, with the kids, and with the organizations are imperative.
So one of the things in the communities that we work that we're grateful for our bosses for having and building great relationship for the commanders in the districts that we work. So what happens is they've changed their mind and they get to thinking a little bit restorative justice. So if they know something's going on in a block, they'll call our bosses and have those conversations. Our boss reads out to us and the team will go and engage these guys. So instead of them just going there and arresting them, they know it's like that's just putting a Band-Aid on the cut.
So they'll call you and say, hey, you know what, check this out. We know this kid's in trouble or leaning towards trouble. We need your help.
But Father Kelly said at the beginning that it was important to get the police to accept what you're doing and see you as allies, not a problem. At first, the police thought what you were doing was a problem?
I think a lot of times, anytime we as citizens, whoever we are, get involved in what the police think is their business, so to speak, that you're in the way. And I think what we're really doing through the street outreach and professionalizing that, and these are people who are really learning the skills, and it's not just, you know, guys just being thrown into the neighborhoods. These are guys that go back. We have a peace academy where they're really honing their skills and working together. Now you have something different in those communities, and the police, I think, are beginning, as Sam said, are beginning to recognize, wait a minute, these guys can be a real help in the overall effort to stop the violence.
Now, here's I wonder too, because we'll always talk in these broad strokes about the relationship between the police and the community. But when you're talking about restorative justice and your organizations being pillars in your community, they do try to have relationships with community. They may not have great relationships with the perpetrators and people who might be on the block who are causing trouble, but they seem, as you just said, Sam, that they're going to call you up. They don't have to do that and say, we know this kid is leaning towards trouble. You want to take a look at, you know, actually getting into that part of it before they go and just and go arrest the kid.
So, for example, one time we had a cafe in one of the districts that we worked. So we brought high risk, the target individuals, and we sat down the outreach team, some of the directors, and we was able to say, what can we do to help you guys to make this work? And the police officers, lieutenants, captains, commander, they sat down. So it was a great conversation that we was able to do that. So just like Father Kelly was saying, so at the Peace Academy, it teaches you that professionalism, right? We have to show that we're no longer what they used to think of us as, those ex-gang members, ex-drug dealers. So it took time to build that. So with a program like the Ready Chicago program, when we go speak to the young guy and say, hey, you could either stay on the corner or we can try this program, right? A different initiative where I can get you an 18-month job. Let's see what that looks like.
So yeah, right.
We're grateful that the commanders that give us a tip, and we can go and say, hey, let us work with you. What's on your mind?
Sarah, I just want to bring you in. You know, the police and a lot of our politicians and the attorney general's office, others, they're going to look at handguns. They need to get these off the street. And they're looking for punitive, they want big sentences for anyone who has a gun. You want handguns off the street. Does that work? Does that work in the way that I mean, you're in concert with the police to say, hey, this is all what we want. We want to get these guns off the street. And the real way we're going to do that is to punish.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious that it's not working, because that's what we've been doing for decades. I will say that I know for sure the Chicago Police Department in particular really excels at getting illegal guns off the streets, which I'm incredibly grateful for. And they deserve, credit for that. But again, it's not only their job, right? It's the job of all of us to give them the tools that they need in order to be able to work together with organizations like Precious Blood and Institute for Nonviolence in order to address this problem. And there's a role that we can play, everyday citizens. It's not right that we just hand it over to the police or to the Father Kelly and his team and Sam and his team to deal with this problem. What we can do in other outside of these communities is we can work, like I said, to give these people the tools they need and the funding that they need. So we can work to give police the tools they need by giving them laws that will help them to cut down on the illegal trafficking of firearms, to help them raise that clearance rate, so we don't just have a situation where 8 or 15% of all murders even result in an arrest in Chicago. Like, there are laws that we can work together to pass that will give the police the tools they need. But just as important, I would even argue more important and more urgent, is those of us outside of these underserved communities can work to make to have the backs of people like Father Kelly and Sam. And what that means is making sure they get fully funded. So the city ordinance to create the Office of Gun Violence Prevention, like I said a little early in the program, we're launching the campaign on this Monday, October 14th, to really put a lot of pressure on the mayor's office to make sure that it's fully funded.
That it wasn't just a, hey, this is great for Chicago, this is going to be a great office, but there's actually teeth to it.
Yeah, there's teeth to it because the ordinance has three major components. One, it will target will allow for targeting of resources to areas of the city where the violence is concentrated, like back of the yards. It will also provide funding for programs that we know work, that are backed up by evidence. And like the ones we've been talking about this evening, it will also create a community advisory process so that the Mayor's Office of Gun Violence Prevention can integrate community perspectives into their work. Okay. And this is really important because in historically so often organizations like at the government level will kind of make the decisions for how these funds should be spent. And really those decisions should be in the hands of people like Sam and Father Kelly.
Let me ask before we go to break, this no snitch policy, this is something that's reared its head in Chicago, and it's very divisive. You have a lot of people who don't live in back of the yards that will text in and say, why don't they help the police? And one way to get guns off the street or stop the violence is that if they help the police. At this point, they're not doing that. So what do you say to living in that community and understanding the community that you serve about why people don't come forward when there's crime?
I'll just speak from my experience is that people don't come forward to the police or other authorities is because they don't think that the authorities have their best interests at heart. So why would I? Do you really care? And I think that's what we're working on, that kind of divide of do the police, do the courts really give a care about what happens in our community, or are we just going through the motions? And why put myself at risk? Why put myself in the line if you aren't really going to do anything with it anyhow? Mm. I think that's ultimately, it goes back to that, what we've been talking about is relationship, that allowing the community to believe the police really do care, and allowing the police to believe that the community really wants to be a part of this if there was a mechanism to do that in
Sam?
That way.
So everybody has a job to do, right? Police had a job to do, and we have a job to do. In one of our videos, one of the commanders says when he went to a homicide shooting, when he left, he felt okay when he seen us in our green uniforms there, right? So it's just us again, and it's just building them relationships. We're trying to be proactive before we get there.
As you give advice to people, and what do you say? Hey, cooperate with the police. Do you know if somebody comes forward and they're like, or maybe I saw something, or I know who shot this person, is the idea to say cooperate with police, or that you're just not there yet?
Well, for outreach workers, the integrity, right? So in order for us to be able to speak to the youth and the high-risk individuals, we don't allow the outreach team to have these conversations with police officers. Because if you do that, then you can no longer go back into the community and help or prevent a shooting, right? So we let our directors, them have those conversations.
Yeah. Panel tonight talking about Chicago violence and specifically in back of the yards, a neighborhood in the south side of Chicago. When we come back, let's talk a little bit about the people that work in your organizations and the trauma that they face as well as they continue to try to help people who are living with violence every day. It's a special program on Chicago violence tonight. 312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break, come back. Stay with us.
That's overwhelming but very rewarding. Right? And knowing that if you help one family, you're helping generations, right? Because they're learning that there is help out there, and they're going to be helping the rest of their family and others throughout the community and giving them that education. And then the more education we put out there, the better support they will get from their community.
That's Elena Calzada. She's a victim advocate for the Institute for Nonviolence Chicago. And what she's talking about there is just about the responsibility she has for her job, but also, that by doing this work and getting in there and talking to victims and trying to change the direction of their lives, that she may be affecting generations, not just families. She had a great conversation with her.
And it's intense work. It's 24/7. You don't know when your phone's going to ring. You don't know when you'll go with someone to the doctor. I don't think we have time for all the interview that we did with Elena, but her job is all-consuming. She'll set up doctor's appointments, mm-hmm. take folks to the doctor, hold their hands while they're getting news and dealing with family, set up funerals for families.
Well, we could play, let's play, it's about 4 minutes, so we could play it here. We could play Elena, who is a victim's advocate for the Institute for Nonviolent Chicago. And you know what? Let's go ahead and play her interview, and we'll play that and we'll come back.
Well, when it's living victims, our goal is to make sure that they heal as 100% as possible. That is to help reduce some of the trauma of the reminder of what happened and also lessen the chance of retaliation. Mm-hmm. And our role is first the medical part. So if they need insurance, we help apply for insurance. If they need a ride to the doctor, making sure they follow up with their appointments. That's the main thing. And then after that, during that process, as we build a relationship going to the doctors, we will start talking about counseling or talking to an outreach person. And sometimes I bring an outreach right away, depending on what they share with me.
You said the word retaliation. I think a lot of people don't recognize how strong of a word that is mm-hmm. and how powerful retaliation is when it comes to the cycle of violence here.
Right. In fact, I was talking to a gentleman yesterday, and he's pretty injured, and it's going to take a long time for him to recover from his injuries. And, you know, we started talking about, like, I know sometimes the anger is going to come out, and you're going to think about retaliation. And he was very open with me, saying, I've thought about it already. And I'm like, and so we had to talk a little bit more about that. And then we talked right away about counseling, and he was willing to do counseling.
What's the impact on you and your staff? It's challenging work, and you have some success, you have some setbacks, undoubtedly. How do you prepare for this work and have the stamina to do it?
I do several things to keep my sanity. So some of the things that I actually do is, like, I love to drive, and so I actually drive Uber. And so I'll do that, especially when it's a really bad day. I'll just go out and drive until I'm like, okay, it's time to go home, right? And sometimes I'll stay out there till like 1 in the morning, because sometimes the cases are very intense. And I see a counselor on a weekly basis. And so that's really, really helpful, especially because we have to learn that we can't carry that burden that hurts, right? Especially when we can't help them. And it's really hard for me when I have to tell them I can't help them. I think my heavier cases is cases of homicide. I think the one that really sticks out is when this little girl, she was 4 years old, and she's seen her mom get shot. And when I went to talk to the grandmother, the little girl's telling me this is what happened. And she hands me over her mother's glasses that had blood on them. But she's talking so innocently. And I always remember her telling me the story of how it happened, because it happened in front of her. So luckily, you know, we have a lot of relationships with other organizations, and they were able to speak to somebody they knew in counseling, and we were able to get them on the top of the line to be seen right away.
As you do this work, and it becomes your life's work, do you notice a change in patterns? Do you notice this process working? Are you saving more people than, say, 10, 15 years ago?
I believe that with our team, it does work. We have several cases where we've had outreach, case management involved, our supervisors involved. And if we're doing the way it was structured, it actually works. I've seen it work. I've seen people build better relationships. You know, we run a support group. I have families that tell me that, you know, they didn't know where to even begin when it came down to making funeral arrangements. And, you know, so I think that we make a really strong impact, and being there long term makes a difference.
Hmm. Helena Calzada, she's a victim advocate for Institute for Nonviolence Chicago. Before we hit the news, Sister Donna talked about this as well, just the trauma of, or just, you know, does it weigh on her? You know, we asked her, does it weigh on her having to talk to all these women about violence in their lives? Let's hear what she has to say.
Well, you know, I always say, first of all, it's a privilege, you know, because to think that these women, mostly African-American, would trust this elderly white woman with their story. And so I always feel it's a privilege. But, yeah, it's difficult sometime after maybe about 5 or 6 stories a day of not only losing a children, but the stories of racism, how they're put down, they're not listened to, they need housing, they're evicted, just so many issues that go along with all of their stories here in this community. And then, you know, to face the death of a son yet, or I think all of them have been deaths of sons that I've dealt with. It's just layer upon layer of trauma. And so I admit, sometimes going home at night is hard to...
You need your own counselor. Which isn't a probably unusual thing.
Yeah.
We talked with some other folks were doing the work at the ministry who openly said they need their own counseling.
Yeah. So, yeah, just going home sometime, you know, I kind of retell those stories to myself. And sometimes, you know, I think, you know, what a privilege. And it is. I'll never change that line. But at the same time, it's just hard to carry so many women's pain. But I'm thankful I can, because I think that sometime I take a little bit of their pain away, maybe, you know, by having listened to their story.
Hmm. Sister Donna Liette, who was a coordinator for Women Families Program at Precious Blood Ministries of Reconciliation. Yeah, some powerful stuff about trauma, Marge, and that's, you know, obviously the people living through it, but also the people, the caregivers and the people that are listening to those stories. It's difficult.
To stick with it, do it day after day, day and night, is a remarkable contribution to the community that can't be diminished or overlooked. I mean, if you hear nothing from this program, you should understand the complexity of the work that's being done in community. People talk a lot of times about, well, you know, are they helping themselves? Well, they are we, first of all. It's our city. But it's not, you know, you think, well, the good, there's a drop-in and a place for young men to go. It's not just a drop-in center. It's a whole network of support and relationships and people who will not ever let you down 24/7. And as we hear, it takes a toll on those who provide the services.
Absolutely.
And we should be grateful for what they do for our city.
Special program, Extension 720, talking Chicago violence tonight. We'll continue the conversation after the news with David Jennings coming up next. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman, and we are doing a program tonight special on Chicago violence. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Marge Halperin is here as well. She is a co-host, and we went down this summer with Pete and the WGN crew to talk with members of the Back of the Yards community, whether it be teenagers, organizations like Precious Blood and the Institute for Nonviolence Chicago, or young moms who were taking part in some of the restorative justice philosophies that take place at Precious Blood Mysteries. We talked a lot about, on the show, a lot of different things, and we still have more to do before 10 o'clock. One of the things we didn't really talk about was, you know, the mentors, the people who are at the actual organizations like Precious Blood and the Institute for Nonviolence. And one of those mentors is Fred Weatherspoon. He's a mentor coordinator for Precious Blood Ministries. He's a very interesting guy, Marge, because, you know, he obviously is doing interesting work trying to get the kids involved or engaged or to make the choice to stay in the community as opposed to going out to the street. And he can kind of do that, not unlike Sam, because he's lived that life. He had a natural life sentence when he was 17 years old.
Right. There was at one point, a dark point, I would say, in Illinois' history where there are mandatory sentences. And at the time, based on his involvement in a crime and a homicide, mandatory sentence to natural life at age 17. At some point later, I don't have my dates, and you guys probably all know, for sure Sam does, where that was thrown out by the courts, because to take a 17-year-old and say that they've made a decision for life is not realistic. And I hope we've heard some of that here today, too.
And Fred is a good example of that, because he's given back to his community after his sentence. So we'll pick up with Fred. We're talking about, and this is also an interesting point, about how difficult it is for kids today, more so than when he was a kid, because you know he was involved in street life, but he could go home and shut it out. Today, kids may not have that stable home, but on top of it, they have other pressures. They have, you know, the street life doesn't stop on the street thanks to technology and what's available in 2019. Here's Fred Weatherspoon.
With social media sort of exploding in the way that it has, there's no safe zone from what we consider trauma. These kids are bombarded with Facebooks and with Instagram. So what they see is the chaos of their community and other communities. For the most part, most of them go home to unstable environments. I can remember when I was a kid, my safe space was when I went home. Like, we turned off the streets. I was able to escape that. But nowadays, there's no safe space for these kids.
So how do you do that as a mentor? Yeah, I mean, how do you create a safe space? How hard is it to tell them to check that stuff at the door?
It's challenging. You know, it's there's a certain desire for change that a participant has to have sort of internally within themselves. And we nurture that. Being a mentor, to me, is much more than just the term mentor. Like, we are much more than that to these kids. We are big brothers. We are father figures. We are disciplinarians, you know. So it's a variety of roles that we play within mentoring. And the kids accept that, you know. There's a buy-in to mm-hmm. this. Because you can't, as you know, this is whether the kids from back of yards, from anywhere, you can't force things upon kids. You know, you can just offer yourself and what it is that this institution offers to the kids, and it's up to them to accept it. And we've been lucky to have a lot of kids just accept what it is we're offering.
And for you, you told me before, you were sentenced to natural life.
Absolutely.
So you could have given up on yourself, but you didn't. Talk to us a little bit about your path to get here from that really desperate kind of sentence.
Absolutely. Well, I was sentenced as a juvenile, 17 years old, to what was a mandatory natural life sentence in the state of Illinois in 1998. And, I knew that at that young age, I wasn't completely, whole I was a child, But during those years of being incarcerated, I got the chance to sort of grow up, and mature and see the world outside of my small little place. You know, I got to experience the way other people see the world and learn from their experience and never accept their natural life senses as my fate, that I would die in prison. I never accepted that. I don't know, a lot of it was godly sort of infused. You know, it was outside of my control, I knew I had no control over that, so I surrendered that unto him. And he guided me through that. And here I am.
Fred Weatherspoon, who's a mentor coordinator over at the Precious Blood Ministries of Reconciliation. Conversation in our studio tonight about Chicago violence. We dedicated the whole program tonight to Chicago violence and Back of the Yards, one of the areas hardest hit by Chicago, or in Chicago, when it comes to gun violence. Our panel in studio, they've been here all night. Thank you for doing so. Sam Castro, Outreach Program Manager with the Institute for Nonviolent Chicago. Father David Kelly, Executive Director over at Precious Blood Ministries of Reconciliation. And Sarah Konishnik, who is the organizer for the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence. You heard that, Sam, and it echoes a lot of what we heard from you earlier in the program. Just this idea that, you make bad choices, and sometimes those choices are going to live with you forever. But as you saw, what you heard from Fred, not unlike what we heard from you earlier, you could make other choices. You could choose at this point to say, I've served my debt to society, I'm out. But you continue to try and work with kids to help them make better choices. When you hear Fred's story, and Fred, why do you do it?
Unfortunately, because of my bad choices then, I helped kind of destroy the community. So I feel like it's the only right thing to do. Help them be that out for them that I didn't have. So we didn't have programs like this when I was growing up. And unfortunately, it led us to do the things we did, and we went to prison and paid for it. So I want to be their example where they don't have to go.
You heard Fred talk about right at the beginning there just about social media and some of the ways that society and street culture permeates beyond the street. They're going into the house now. There is no safe space. There is no stable place that you can shut it out. Do you see that in your work, Father Kelly? Do you see that social media follows these kids wherever they go?
Oh, yeah, every day. I mean, one of the big issues we have with our young people, especially as they look for employment, and when we're talking about teenage young people, we're really talking about up to the mid-20s or early 30s. I mean, that's the population we're kind of talking about. But one of the things that social media does is because it's no longer confined to you just to your little neighborhood, but because your face go on Facebook and Instagram and all the other kinds of social medias that they have, all of a sudden you're known, maybe not known intimately, but your face is known. So many of our young people can't take public transportation. So they can't get on the bus. They have afraid to get on the bus. Wow. Because of that social media having their face. And they use that as a platform to taunt and to degrade one another. And so that's part of the problem, that all of a sudden this... there is no safe space. It's not like I can go home and, you know, they're buried into those smartphones and things like that. But it creates a different kind of element here that is really problematic.
It's like the new street corner, right?
Yeah.
Is a street corner right here in your hand. You don't have to go outside. Maybe it's less physical risk in the short term. Mm-hmm. But what you're saying is long term, you've still put yourself out there. You've taunted others. Yep. Next time you are visible, you're in that much more danger.
And Sam, you mentioned it earlier, just in the, I think, one of the more poignant moments of this program, the idea that two black men, young black men in hoodies who don't know each other, who cross each other in the street, they have to shoot. Right? They for whatever reason, I don't know you, but I'm going to shoot. Sarah, when you hear that kind of thing and you hear how social media kind of works, and I know my old buddy Rob Wildebohr, who's a criminal justice reporter, did a story one time about how people could buy guns easier than they can buy weed. And they could buy for...
not for long.
Yeah, but yeah, right. But the idea being that it's cheap and it's like somebody on the corner opening up their jacket. I mean... you could see with all the things we're just talking about, degrading online, having this sort of machismo that you have to show up to strangers, and the ability to get a gun for peanuts. It all kind of comes together.
Yeah, it certainly does come together, and I think it highlights the complexity of the problem. And I think one of the comments I made at the beginning of the program is we have to realize that it's a very complex problem with many different types of solutions, and we all have a role to play. There's just so much to learn and to do, and so many different ways to get involved. And this may be my last chance. We're coming up on the end of the program, so I just want to announce my email address. It is literally my job. If there's anyone out there at the grassroots level, just everyday people who really want to have a bigger impact on affecting on reducing gun violence, on supporting organizations like the Institute for Nonviolence Chicago and Precious Blood Ministry, but also hundreds of other organizations that are doing great work to reduce different types of gun violence in different types of communities, please email me at Sarah, S-A-R-A, K as in King, at I, C as in Cat, H, V as in Victor, .org. It is my job to make it as easy as possible for you to get involved in a way that's really meaningful anywhere in the state of Illinois. So please reach out to me.
All right. So here's what we're going to do. We'll take our break here. We come back. We got to talk about what's next. And it's 2019. We've seen homicides and shootings go down this year. Do you feel like it's the work of the community, the police, the mayor, the communities? What's driving it? But what is the next steps? What, as we look in the fall of 2019, and we kind of look at what happened this summer, and also look ahead to what could happen this winter and spring, let's have that conversation here before we wrap up on Extension 720. Stay with us. Extension 720 tonight, examining Chicago violence through the lens of the work that's being done in Back of the Yards. And you heard tonight so many different people who live and work in the Back of the Yards community talking about how gun violence affects them. In studio tonight, Father David Kelly, Sam Castro, Sarah Knizek, and also Marge Halperin, who has been our co-host tonight. All right, so as we have just a couple minutes left here. 2019, here we are, the work that you've been doing, you've dedicated your lives to this. Is this a moment? Are we in a moment in Chicago where you've seen the president tweeting about it and the mayor getting in spats on Twitter and everyone feeling like there's the teapot is getting hotter? Are we at a moment where you're seeing change or affect change here in Chicago, Father Kelly?
I don't know if we're at a moment, but I think we're at a place where decisions have to be made. And I think one of the things that we have to make as a society is, are we really going to be holistic as we tackle some of these issues? We will never police our way out of this. We will never incarcerate our way out of this. Kids carry guns because they don't feel safe, not because they want to do harm. And so I've been doing this a long time, 40 years, and for the first time, we have a plan. There are communities across this city coming together, and we sit together a lot. And we meet, and we talk, and we plan, and we've developed a plan in which I think will really have an impact. It's been privately funded by funders, and we have been able to put together this outreach, this case management, this community engagement called Light in the Night. We've partnered with Ready and CRED and all these other organizations throughout the city. There's a lot of these organizations working together in tandem for the first time. And we've had now a few years of steady funding to help do some of this work.
Mm-hmm.
And it has allowed us to do other work because of this work. And what I hope for, and I think what we all hope for, is that we'll get some public funding for this. That we're looking for $50 million to really fund this so that we can really strengthen the architecture, but also to bring in more communities.
That's such a huge number.
Yeah.
It's a huge number. I mean, I'll be honest with you. To hear the mayor come on and say we got an $800 million budget hole, and to hear that that the plan to fund was $50 million, I mean, how do we find that money? How do we do it? Sarah?
Well, I think a better way to look at it is to think about the costs that this problem is imposing on us as a city. Each gun homicide costs $1.5 million in healthcare, policing, and prosecution costs. We simply can't afford for this to go on much longer. $50 million, when you start adding up, for example, in 2018, there were 561 homicides in Chicago. If you add that, if you do the math, that equals well over $840 million. When you look at it that way, $50 million really kind of looks like a bargain.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know I'm driving the point home, but I just can't say it often enough. This incredible work that we've been hearing about tonight has been done by the incredible people you've heard from, and it's been backed up by private funding. That is not sustainable. Those of us throughout the city, no matter what community we live in, we have to demand public level funding so that this incredible work can continue and we can continue to see these violence rates go down.
You know, it's interesting because we sit in here in the Cochran Show and I'd have Mayor Emanuel would come through. And I remember Mayor Emanuel saying and having this impassioned plea on the program one time saying all violence can be fixed with more parental responsibility.
I'd like to throw in his solution was also to put more cops in the street.
Sure, sure.
Very expensive, but not nearly as effective as the work.
Sure, but you're seeing, you know, I have texters tonight saying, what about parents? At the end of the day, the investment in communities have to go through parents to be able to reach their kids. What do you say to that? What do you say to people who may not live in those communities telling you that's the way it should be?
I agree. I definitely think that at the very core of this is that family structure. But you've got to help families to. Every mother I've ever met loves their child. Every mother I've ever met. Not every mother has the wherewithal to be able to care for their child in the way that they want to. There's so much stress and strain. You have mothers who are working three jobs. They're doing heroic work against all odds. And I think when we start to have organizations like ours go in and support a mom, then that mom is better able to really create that environment that everybody says ought to be there. You cannot do that by stricter laws and organizations that, you know, close their doors at 5 o'clock, those kinds of things. And I think, you know, I agree with that wholeheartedly, but it's a bigger picture. You can't lay this all on moms.
Sam, what do you think about that? What do you think about parental responsibility?
In order for us to continue that great work, now that we have a structure that truly combats violence, we We need this to be supported not only by individuals, but public structures. So I think for me, the next step is to sustain the 2-year collaboration between CP4P and READY. So in order for us to continue to do this, because what happened before, they would fund it, we'll do it for 6 months, and here comes the water breaking down the sandcastle.
That's how politics work,
and
right?
We have to start again.
But when it comes to parental responsibility, and you hear this all the time, and you talked about the lack of fathers in the communities, do you believe that that has something to do with the fact that communities are riddled with violence?
Well, I believe so, because so they took the father away. Now the street is the father. So if they don't have us to steer them in the right direction, they end up in jail. So the cycle never stops.
Yeah. A lot of it's about the cycle, Father Kelly. And we talked about retaliation a little bit tonight. We talked about generational cycles. We didn't really get into poverty march. We didn't get into race. But there,
healthcare, education.
All of these cycles seem to play a big role when it comes to the health of a community and whether or not you see issues like gun violence come through.
Sure. I mean, if we focus on punishment, we further the violence, and it just perpetrates more violence. If we focus on healing, then we stop the violence. We really allow people to heal so they don't have the retaliation, because they have Elena, as we heard on the video or the audio, walking alongside. You have Sister Donna's who can sit with folks. And we have outreach team and victim advocates going to the hospital and talking to folks who've been harmed so that the retaliation is lessened by major factors. You have others in their lives that help someone so that retaliation is not the only thing they have.
Marge, it's been a great program tonight, and thank you for your contributions and for getting us really to learn more about the community back of the yards and to understand some of the issues with gun violence. What's your takeaway here? As we wrap up, what's your takeaway from this?
Well, I think the kinds of healing approaches that Father Kelly's talking about, you know, it's what we want to do in our own lives, right? You have a fight with a family member, a spouse, and you think, well, they come from a place of love. They're not really trying to hurt me. Let's talk it through. That's a healthy relationship. Why wouldn't we want that kind of relationship between young men in the street, between people in every community, between communities? Why wouldn't we, as Sarah says, want to go down to back of the yards and have that relationship with our neighbors? We're one city, and if there's any message, it's we're one city. You ask why we should spend $50 million, I think we should spend twice that. We should get the job done so that our whole city can heal, because these young men that go to jail and these moms that are hurting, they're not out doing work that could benefit the city. They're not working to beautify our parks. They're not writing books or creating art or doing the things that they could do if they were freed in their life that would make our whole city better. And we all have a stake in this.
That's Marge Halperin. Father David Kelly, Executive Director of the Precious Blood Ministries of Reconciliation. Sam Castro, Outreach Program Manager with the Institute for Nonviolent Chicago. And Sarah Kanisnik, who's the organizer for the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence. Thank you all for joining us tonight here on Extension 720. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.